This is the Rogue Startups Podcast, Episode 8. All right, well, we sure are in for a treat today. The guest for the show today is Mike Tabor. I'm sure everybody knows Mike from the Startups for the Rest of His podcast. Mike is getting ready to come out with the brand new book he'll be releasing any day now called The Single Founder Handbook. And this is going to be just an absolute reference for everyone who's bootstrapping a business online of how to validate an idea, how to market, how to create the product itself, how to sell, how to scale, how to outsource. Mike covers everything. It's going to be absolutely soup to nuts, everything you need to know to start a business online and to be successful. We're also going to dig into a softer side of things with Mike. You know, if you guys follow his podcast, you'll know last year he went through a bit of a tough patch in his life where he was really dealing with what ended up being, you know, burnout is kind of how he classifies it, but it really is just being overwhelmed and questioning kind of some of the assumptions you have about your life and what you're doing and if you're being successful and if you're kind of achieving your goals. And we're calling this episode 50 Shades of Burnout because it really is a spectrum. You're not just going to wake up one day and realize you're not somewhere that you want to be, but you want to be able to understand and recognize some of these patterns and warning signs in your life early so that you can step in and intervene and do something about it so that you can stay on the right course and be successful in life. Mike was able to do that last year, but he probably had to learn the hard way. And so hopefully we're able to impart some of his knowledge and experience for you guys, the audience, so that you don't have to learn the hard way. You can kind of learn from some of his experiences and maybe avoid some of the pains and some of the troubles that he had in the past year or so. So we got a sneak peek at Mike's book. It'll be coming out any day now at thesinglefounderhandbook.com. And we're just really pleased and it's our honor for Dave and I to have on the show today, Mike Tabor. All right, guys, today on the show, we have Mike Tabor. I'm sure everyone knows Mike from the Startups for the Rest of Us podcast. He also is the co-founder of MicroConf and the Micropreneur Academy. Mike, we're really glad to have you on the show today. Thanks for taking a few minutes out of your day to come chat with Dave and I on the Rogue Startups podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Mike, you know, you were probably one of the first people to kind of go public about just how burnout had affected your life last year at MicroConf, and it was a very powerful discussion to be a part of and listen to your presentation on that. And so that got Craig and I thinking about, you know, things that we wanted to discuss on the podcast, and obviously burnout is something that everybody runs into, but in particular, it seems like entrepreneurs are more susceptible to this than others, especially if you're doing this as sort of a solo venture. And if you hit burnout, you know, oftentimes you have no idea whether you're actually burned out or not. And I know you've thought a lot about this, and your new book that's coming out, The Single Founder Handbook, relates some of these topics in what is a very in-depth set of content for entrepreneurs there. It looks really awesome. And I was wondering if you would be interested in talking a little bit about burnout with us here today, since you seem to be a bona fide expert on it and willing to talk about it.
Well, I wouldn't call myself an expert on it, but sure. I mean, I definitely love to, you know, share some of my knowledge and experiences on the topic.
Great, great. So let's kind of dive in and say, how am I going to recognize what burnout really is here?
That's a good question, but it's really tough to answer as well. And the reason it's tough to answer is because if you're looking at your own life and you're looking at the things that you have to do, then your brain is kind of responding and kind of giving you this picture of what your life looks like and, you know, all the different problems that it is that you are experiencing. And if, you know, and depending on exactly what's going on in your head, you know, if there's problems with what your brain is telling you. So for example, if you like you have a serious chemical imbalance or something like that, there's something fundamentally wrong with the sensor that is feeding your brain information about your life. So how do you recognize that you're even in that situation? It's it becomes a very difficult question to answer. I mean, you can almost relate it back to the philosophical question of, you know, how do you know that you exist? Well, in this particular case,
I don't think we're going to go into Cartesian logic today.
Sure, sure. But, you know, it's very, you know, it relates to that. It's like, how do you know that, you know, things are okay in your life? You know, because your brain is what's feeding you that information. And if there's something wrong with your brain, how is it going to be able to give you this idea of whether or not something is wrong? You know, sure. It's like the NASA systems, for example, on the space shuttle have triple redundant systems. And if, you know, even if one of them goes out, it's not really a big deal. But again, if you're looking at your own life, how do you know that things are wrong? And I think that to do that, you have to look externally. You have to look at what your accomplishments are in relation to what other people's and where you expect that you should be. Now, it's not to say that you're going to be there, but if you find yourself in a position where you are constantly not living up to your own expectations, then, you know, you may very well be burned out. And I think that's kind of the benchmark that people have to look at. The caveat to that is you do have to be a little bit careful that you're not comparing your day-to-day life against the highlight reels that you see of other people, because you know, when you go out and you read blogs or TechCrunch or, you know, any of these news sites that have entrepreneurial stories, you'll hear these people who are just knocking it out of the park, and you don't want to, you know, compare your day-to-day life to just that highlight reel, because it's going to be very demoralizing and it's not a fair comparison.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that, because I was like, if I had to compare my life to Elon Musk every day, I'd feel just completely inadequate for the rest of my life. So
I think we all would.
I know. Hey, so Mike, I have a question regarding that, you know, and talking about comparing yourself to other people. Do you think there's a time component to this as well, where you don't just wake up one day and realize, ah, that, you know, the world's falling in around me, or I'm no good and this is something I can't do? Is it kind of a gradual thing where you kind of work up to a point where it's not acceptable or not good enough for you anymore? And how does that play into, I guess, the kind of the process you go through as a business person? I mean, you're always hopefully moving a little bit forward. Is the time continuum of how you think about that play into what your business reality is?
Yeah, I mean, time definitely plays a part in it. And it goes both ways, not just towards success, but towards failure as well. Because if you start procrastinating, and the example I like to use is if you're kind of going down this road towards burnout. Let's say that you're like a frog in a pot of water, and the classic example is, you know, if you take a frog and you throw it in a pot of boiling water, it's going to jump out. But if you put it in a pot of water and you slowly rise the temperature, it will boil itself to death. Now, scientifically, that's not true at all. I mean, it's just a common example that for some reason has made its rounds through the internet, and people believe that that's what happens, but the frog will actually jump out.
Have you tested this with your sons?
I have not, but I'm sure that at some point they will probably throw a frog in some water, and you know, hopefully I can catch it in time.
Hopefully.
But facts aside, you know, if you're just looking at that particular example, you can envision a scenario where somebody is slowly getting more and more burned out over time, and they just simply don't realize it. The flip side of it is that you're becoming more successful and you start taking bigger risks. I mean, there's a lot of things that in your environment are going to influence your thinking and how you react to it. So it does work both ways. It works both on the path towards burnout and towards success.
Yeah, I can just see a scenario where you're being more successful all the time, and all the time you're being more critical of yourself, and then you just wake up one day and say, it's never going to be good enough.
Well, I think that, you know, never being good enough is one of those frames of mind as well. I don't think that most people just wake up one day and say, oh my God, I'm no good anymore. I think it's definitely a gradual process, but at the same time, I also think that if you are at a certain level of success, let's say that you've got enough income to support yourself and you're making your living on a monthly basis and it's really not that hard, let's say you're in a scenario where you're kind of coasting from month to month, you have to think about like what your larger goals in life are. And I actually talk about that in my book a little bit, that like you have to know what your long-term goals are and understand that it's not just attaining those goals, because let's say that your goal is to reach $10,000 a month in revenue. Well, once you get that, then what? You know, do you just decide, okay, now I'm going to go for $100,000 or $150,000? Probably not, because you're at a point where you're essentially self-sufficient. So what drives you? What motivates you to keep going? Because otherwise, like, you've got nothing to live for at that point. I mean, you've already met your goals, so, you know, what's next? But the fact is, you have to have something. And whether that's your family or whether that's, you know, just going through the entrepreneurial journey or having these other goals in life, you want to have all these other experiences, you have to have something there because, you know, any goal that you meet, you're eventually going to meet it if you put the time and effort into it and, you buckle down enough. But again, there's got to be something else there for you. What is it that drives you on a daily basis to get out of bed?
So you mentioned motivation here. And one thing that I've always struggled with is whether I'm just feeling, you know, in a patch of low motivation or if I'm really, truly burned out. Now, I mean, we kind of joked about this before the podcast started, but it's kind of like the 50 shades of burnout, right? So how do I know where I sit on that spectrum and, you know, how can I fix that?
I heard a really good analogy the other day that somebody was – it wasn't an analogy. It was an example of what somebody was doing. And if you remember from stories about Steve Jobs, for example, he would look at himself in the mirror every morning and say, you know, am I doing the best for myself? Am I happy with the path that I'm on? Are things going in the way that I want them to be? And if they're not, then he decide, you know, if they're not for enough days in a row, then he would decide, hey, I need to do something different. And the technique that I had overheard somebody say several days ago was do the same thing at the end of each day, but put a smiley face or a sad face on the calendar based on how well you think you did that day. You know, did you meet your goals? Was it a good day? And if you have enough of those in a row or in a clustered area where it's like you're not even 50-50, you know, if you're, let's say, 30%, unhappy faces, then something's probably wrong. I mean, you're either, you know, not reaching your goals or, you're not motivated or you're burned out or something along those lines. There's something wrong and you have to get to the root of it and figure out what that is.
Okay. Now, I noticed that in your book, you talk a lot about motivation. How does motivation come back to fixing or changing where you're at in a burnout situation?
Well, it's funny because they feed into each other. You know, success begets success and failure begets failure. So if you are on this path where you are having success, you're meeting your goals, you're going to be encouraged to keep doing what you're doing because you're having success. If the opposite is true, if you're not meeting your goals, you're going to become discouraged and you're going to not want to go do those things. So it's in some ways, it's a catch-22. You're almost in this, you know, this avalanche or the snowball situation where you can't stop it. Like as soon as you start going in one particular direction, it's going to keep going in that direction unless you essentially break the cycle. How do you break the cycle? And I talk about that in my book about some of these different hacks that you can try in order to break that cycle. And, you know, there's a lot of different productivity hacks out there. There's things like don't break the chain. There's the Pomodoro technique. There's getting things done. There's a lot of different things that you can do. But essentially what they boil down to are these psychological forcing functions where you're essentially forcing yourself to do things regardless of what that outcome looks like. And you have to try and use those to break the cycle. Now, if you try them enough and you're not able to break the cycle, then you need to take a step back and say, okay, well, I've tried these short-term hacks. They're not working. Is there something larger that's wrong here that needs to be addressed first?
Can you actually give me a specific example where you've used one of those hacks and gotten through a patch like that on your own?
Yeah, actually in writing the book. So there were several times where I would sit down and my goal was to, you know, write a couple of thousand words a day. And I would sit down and I would try writing and I wasn't doing it. And what I realized was happening was I was doing everything except writing. I was doing all the things that, you know, would need to be done to run my business, to help with Founder Cafe, to help with MicroConf, and do all these things other than writing, which really the only, you know, measure of progress that really matters for writing a book is, you know, how many words are you writing on a daily basis? How many words are you getting to total? And what I realized, I was just not making progress. So what I did was I have this app on my phone called Focus Time that all you do is it's basically an implementation of the Pomodoro technique. And I just added in a category that says writing. And I would just sit down and I would just hit the button and I would make it a game. And my goal was to write as much as I possibly could inside of one Pomodoro. And of course, you know, when you kind of distill problems down into very, very small time slices, it's not that hard to do. Like if I sat down and I say, well, I've got 8 hours to write, I've got 8 hours to write and I can procrastinate a lot. I mean, that's, you know, one of the technology laws out there is called Parkinson's law, is that work expands so as to fill all available time. If you give somebody a report and say you've got 4 weeks to do it, they're not going to start it on until week three. And, you know, but the same thing happens with writing. I mean, I gave myself a couple of months to write and I'm, you know, I would sit there and I'd say, well, I've got 8 hours today. I don't really have anything else to do. And then I wouldn't write until afternoon or 1 or 2 o'clock. So I found that by using this as essentially a psychological forcing function, I could get myself into the mode of writing, and then it very, very quickly snowballed. So I would write as fast as I could for that 25 minutes, because 25 minutes is not that long a time period. You can force yourself to do something for that 25 minutes. And then you look at your progress and say, wow, I actually did quite a bit. I wonder if I can double that if I do it again, or if I can triple it or quadruple it by the end of the day. So you make it a series of little tiny games, and you look at it at the micro level instead of the macro level.
I'm sure you looked at this kind of in hindsight a little bit, but Nathan Barry talks about this in his book Authority, and he takes it a step further to say, just pick the chapter or the topic you're most interested in that day. So you're not even writing the book in order, if you will, by chapter or by section, but you say, hey, today I feel like writing about this. I'm going to go grab an hour of this a day, instead of forcing yourself to go into the next bucket, which could further kind of reduce your productivity and excitement about getting that done. I think that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, I think that works a lot better when everything's greenfield, when you just have all the chapters kind of laid out. But like as you get further and further along, it becomes more difficult because there may be topics you don't necessarily want to write about, but people have asked about. So like as you're list of work gets smaller and smaller, chances are good that the things that are left on that list are the things that you have pushed off and procrastinated on because you didn't want to do them and you still don't want to do them. So, but they're the ones that are left. So you still have to figure out how to get those done.
Very apropos as we're approaching tax season, right?
Yes.
Hey, I got my taxes done. I just got them back today. So
show off.
Show off.
So Mike, so that's a really cool, I think, mindset approach to, on a micro level, as you said, kind of getting through those rough patches. When you realize you're kind of already there, aside from day-to-day kind of hacks, if you will, of getting through the work, what other things aside from actual work are good things to either include or to eliminate from maybe the rest of your life when you're looking at how to kind of get out of the valley, if you will?
I think that probably the biggest thing is to eliminate the number of decisions that you have to make in the moment. I found that, you know, there's this big problem with decision fatigue where, especially for entrepreneurs, because they can literally work on anything that they want at almost any time. And that becomes a problem because you've got so many choices of things to work on. And what tends to happen is you end up with this massive decision fatigue where you won't make any decision because you've got so many decisions that you could make. There's so many options, you won't make any. And that's especially a problem for people who have recently gone full time on entrepreneurship, because, you know, what should be at the top of your priority list? You know, what should you be working on today? What is going to move the needle for you? And some people don't necessarily know, but even if you do know, or if you have a good idea, there might be 5 or 8 or 10 different things that are kind of, you know, high level, high priority things to do. So which one should you work on first? And if there's too many of them, you won't work on any, which obviously is one of those things that becomes a problem. So I think in cases like that, you need to try some other techniques like time boxing and say, okay, well, I'm going to work on all 10 of these things, but I'm only going to work on them 1 hour at a time. And I'm going to rotate through all 10 of them, and I'm going to put 4 hours of time this entire week into each of them. So at least that way you're making some progress on all of them, but you also have to be careful about making sure that you set aside that time for only those tasks and you're not pushing things off and saying, oh, well, I've still got 30 hours left this week. You know, if you diligently schedule those times, then it will work out a lot better for you, just because you have pre-made those decisions when you're like at the very beginning of your week, you decide this is what I'm going to work on and this is when I'm going to work on it. And then when those pre-designated times come, your job is not to decide whether or not to work on it. Your job is to work on it. So it takes away the decision-making capability at that time. You can't decide, well, I'm going to go to the gym instead. No, that's, you know, that's against the rules. So you have to put these rules into place and you have to schedule these things in advance. And when you get there, just recognize, hey, you're the one who put this together. It made sense at the time and you were probably at the height of your decision-making ability at that time.
So you talk about going full-time as an entrepreneur. I know that back in December, you recently quit your consulting job and went full-time now doing, you know, solely Audit Shark and the Single Founder Handbook. Have you implemented a similar structure for that? What does that look like? And how does that play into, you know, avoiding burnout, changing your prioritization, and dealing with time pressures?
I have. And, you know, actually, I went full-time back in June. And it was probably around November or December when I realized that some of these things that I was not doing were kind of dramatically hurting my progress. So that's kind of, you know, part of it came up as stuff to go into the book, kind of as I realized how much this stuff was hurting me. And I, you know, reached out and was talking to people as part of the book, and it kept coming up over and over again. Like, how do I solve motivation? How do I make sure that I'm moving things forward? And I realized that those problems were not limited to just me. Like, lots of other people have these problems, but I don't think that people have a good way to not necessarily talk about them, but people's terminology is a little bit different. Their recognition and understanding of what the problem is a little bit different. So they don't use the same words. They don't use the same terms. But in seeing, like, you know, more than 100 emails from people, I asked people, anyone who'd signed up for the email list for the book, I sent them an email and I said, you know, list your top three challenges in your business. And by and large, lots and lots of responses came back with some variation of maintaining motivation and staying on task and things like that. And you know, in just a couple of email discussions, I realized very quickly that I'm not the only one with this problem. There's lots of people who have this problem, but they're having a hard time recognizing that that is the problem.
Sure, sure. Well, you said that you use this for some specific things. So give me an example of one of those.
Sure. So what I did was I essentially set up a schedule for myself. So what I did, like, all through December, and I kind of tested this as well. I tested it in December and then I kind of backed off of it in January just to see what happened and, you know, how my progress changed. And in December, I made a lot of progress. And in January, I did not make nearly as much progress. So I kind of attribute it to that. But essentially what I did was at the beginning of the week on Sunday nights, what I would do is I would set out what my schedule was going to look like for the week. And I would divide it up into a couple of hour blocks. And I would say, okay, for these couple of hours, I'm going to do this. For these hours, I'm going to do this. I would schedule my times to go to the gym. I would schedule my times for cooking dinner because my wife she's a fitness instructor. So she's out of the house for some evenings. So I'm on, you know, dinner patrol with the kids. And what I did was I basically blocked out my entire schedule for the week. And what I found was by doing that, it took away a lot of the decisions that I had to make during the day, and it made me more capable of making the decisions that I need to in the moment during those blocks of time.
Any technology around that? I mean, just is that Google Docs or Evernote or something like that, or did you have an app for it?
No, I used Google Docs, but I also printed out calendars that I found online where you can just go out and you just enter in the names or the hours that you want it to show. So I could do it either way. I sometimes I would just like write it out on paper first, and then I would transfer it over into my Google Doc. But if you looked at my into my Google Calendar, like, my hours were booked solid just about every single day. So it was very regimented in some cases. And then as I backed off of it, I realized that I was probably not making nearly as much progress. But it's, in some ways you can look at that and say, is that an extreme that you have to go to? And I don't think that you do. I think that it depends on the situation that you're in. Some people will need a lot more structure and some people don't need as much, which again is, I think, where some of the disconnect comes from between people that are talking to one another, because somebody says, oh, I have this problem with procrastination, and somebody else says, oh, I think I'm burned out. And the level of structure that they need may be different, and the words that they use to describe their situation are different, even though the same techniques can help them.
So I read this on Quora just before we got on the podcast, and somebody had said, well, what's a good remedy for burnout? And some other guy answered and said, oh, well, passion will fix burnout. What do you think about that? I actually thought it was kind of a crazy answer myself.
I think if you're in the midst of burnout, hearing a silver bullet answer like that is not helpful. And the reason I think it's not helpful is because it doesn't tell you what to do. You know, you look at that and say, well, what am I supposed to have passion in? And I think you need to know what it is that you're passionate about and what things you're working on and why is it that you're working on. You have to have goals. You have to have these ideas in your head of what it is that you want. And, you know, money isn't necessarily enough. I mean, if that was it, I mean, you look at the movie Office Space where, you know, he asked Peter Gibbons what he would do if he had $1 million. And he's like, I would do nothing. I would sit on my ass and I would do absolutely nothing. And he's like, well, you don't need $1 million to do that. But the reality is, like, what would you do if you had all the money in the world? And you have to kind of, you know, if you are that person who's kind of sitting in that burnout condition, you have to figure out what is it that drives you? What is it that's going to motivate you and move you forward? I mean, passion, I think it's too simplistic an answer. I think it's a lot more, the actual solution is going to be a lot more in depth than that, but it does relate to passion. I mean, if you have something that you're passionate about, you're going to buckle down and you're going to work on it. But how do you get to that point? Because I think that there's this chasm between being burned out and being passionate about a problem. And the person who is burned out doesn't see the path to cross that chasm to get to the point where they're passionate about the problem in order to work on it and get past, you know, the chasm that's already there, the chasm between burnout and productivity.
Yeah, you know, Mike, I think one of the things that Dave and I think and hope that this show is unique is we come from pretty different perspectives. You know, Dave is an experienced kind of software founder, and I'm maybe a little more on the beginning side of it, but I think we both relate to this in different ways. And for me, at least, as someone who's kind of had some false starts in beginnings, I don't know if I've been burnt out, but I've definitely been down in the dumps about getting started. And to me, I would replace the word passion with purpose, because I think when you have purpose and when you have a vision for where this is going and where it could go, then those hours and those days and that schedule and what you're doing all this for and the sacrifice you're making all kind of make sense in your head. And for me, as kind of more of a beginner than you guys, for sure, I think that's a cool thing for everyone probably to be able to keep in mind is purpose and knowing why you're doing all this is a great remedy for me. And I've just kind of found this recently is a great kind of remedy for justifying everything that we do.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that, you know, whether you call it passion or purpose, I think that there's probably some, you know, fine-grained nuances between them. Generally speaking, I probably see them as very similar. Some people may see them as very different. But whether you call it passion or purpose or whether your definitions vary, like I said, you have to have something that drives you. What is it? And you need to know what that is. If you don't know what that is, you need to find it before you start, you know, trying to, you know, tackle these, you know, world challenge problems, I'll say.
Well, so Mike, tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, the book itself, you can find it at singlefounderhandbook.com, and it's aimed at developers and entrepreneurs or developers who want to become entrepreneurs. And it kind of walks you through the process of, you know, being kind of very early on where you don't necessarily know what it is that you want to do, but you know, you're, at least you have it in the back of your mind that you want to start a business. So it looks at the, you know, whether you would want to have co-founders or what your, you know, day-to-day life is going to look like. What is it that drives you? I mean, I ask that flat out and, you know, tell, you know, one of the exercises is go through this and figure out what it is that drives you, because that's going to help you through those low spots. And then it talks a lot about some of the different fears that people have, motivation, you know, time management, planning, focusing on things, making sure that you're tracking your time so that you know how much time and effort you're spending on something and whether or not it's time to pull the plug or do outsourcing. And then there's an entire section on building products, which walks you through idea generation to idea filtering, idea validation, and then idea execution. And then I also have some chapters in there on how to do outsourcing. And then there's a layout for how to build a marketing plan, which is probably one of the more important sections of it. But it basically walks you through all of the different essential elements of what needs to go into a marketing plan and how those things should relate to one another. Because if you have, for example, a goal, I mean, you have to have it's got to be achievable. It's got to be, you know, attainable for you. You've got to have all these different preconditions for that. And the rest of the marketing plan ties back into that. And then I also have an entire section on maintaining yourself as an entrepreneur, because if you're not, the analogy that I use is, if you think of yourself as an engine and your engine is powering the business, if you're not functioning properly, then your business is not going to function properly and it's not going to go where it needs to go. So if you break down, then your business is essentially sunk, especially in the early days when you're kind of making this transition. So there's a lot of stuff in there about how to use forcing functions to enable yourself to do things, and then talk a little bit about mastermind groups, how to structure them. And then I also talk about personal retreats and how to structure those in order to help with the entrepreneurial journey.
So of all the sections that are in the book, what would you say is your favorite and why?
I would probably say the one on routine maintenance, basically taking care of yourself and making sure that you're on a path that you're happy with and that you're happy with your progress, and being able to kind of objectively evaluate where you're at. And if you're not where you want to be, how to figure out why.
Yeah, that's super important. I was actually having a conversation with Rob the other day in email, specifically about why we're doing what we're doing here. And the question of like acquisition came up, and would you want your business to be acquired, and why would that be important, and what's the outcome of that? And both of us were kind of going back and forth and realized that we had the same take on this, and that was, we're kind of optimizing our business strategy. I called it optimizing for culture, but basically you could say it's optimizing for your lifestyle as well. Like, I just don't want to work for anybody anymore. I've gotten so tired of that. And most entrepreneurs feel the exact same way. I know that you have been a consultant for a long time, so you know what it's like to work for yourself. And that's a hugely motivating thing, to be in control of your destiny and your career, and not just be subject to, you know, performance reviews on a whim and HR edicts and crazy stuff like that, that a lot of people are willing to put up with. And that just doesn't fit in culturally. So being able to have a specific plan to set that up, to set that culture up, seems really important. So that's really awesome. I look forward to actually reading that section in particular.
I'll echo that too. Just as someone who still lives in the corporate world, I look at some of the structure that's around me as a bit of a good thing. I mean, you don't have to think about some of these things, talking about the structure of your life and how to structure your week and everything. And living in a corporate world a little bit, I have to say, okay, well, I have to do this and I have to do this and I have to do this. When you take away all the have to's as an entrepreneur, then I can imagine it gets like a big black box sometimes when you think about where you can go. So thinking about ways to systematize and organize not just your work life, but your physical health and your relationship health and everything, I think is probably something that a lot of people get astray on, especially in the first couple of years. You know, you go all gangbusters the first year, and then you realize you're kind of sideways in some of these things. How to course correct, if you will, routine maintenance to get back into a good spot. That's great. I look forward to that as well.
Yeah, there was something else you just kind of mentioned was something else I cover in the book, is about building systems inside of your business, because there are certain things that you don't necessarily want to work on, but they still have to get done, like payroll, for example. It's one of those things where you want payroll to run, but you don't ever actually have to want to deal with it. So, that's just a very simplistic example, but there's lots of other things that come up throughout the course of a year. So for example, at the end of the year, you might give out yearly bonuses, or you might do reviews for your contractors or employees or something along those lines. And you want to make sure that those things are at least scheduled and you do them on a regular basis, even though you don't necessarily want to do them or you don't think about them enough, but you still need to do certain things, and putting systems and processes in place to make sure that those things get taken care of so that they don't drop through the cracks is extremely important to your business, because a business is all about having these systems in place. And a lot of the things I talked about earlier, like the Pomodoro technique and getting things done and, you know, don't break the chain, those things are just systems. It's just like, it's like this little mini process that's part of a much larger system. And if you look at any given business, it's this giant system of, you know, little Lego building blocks that kind of all fit together. And as soon as you build something new, like you throw a new Lego block on there and they all have to fit together. And if they're not fitting together, then, you know, it's going to look like Frankenstein, and it's probably not going to be good in the end.
Indeed.
I have a question about the structure and kind of the technical stuff of the book. So how did you write the book? Did you write it in Scrivener or did you write it in Word? And kind of can you talk about how you're planning on releasing it and some of the technical things about producing the book?
Sure. I will warn you in advance, since this was my first book, everything was kind of a mess. And in retrospect, there are a lot of things I would probably do significantly differently. That said, what I did was I wrote it in Scrivener. And then as I involved an editor, and I would definitely recommend if you're going to write a book or anything of, you know, substance, you definitely want to have an editor to kind of look over your shoulder and make sure that your editing is going well. Or at least your writing process is going well and everything's consistent. So I wrote it in Scrivener initially, and then I exported it to Word, and then I copy-pasted it into Google Docs so that we could both work on the same thing. Unfortunately, once it got past a certain length, Google Docs kind of fell over and choked on itself. I distinctly remember asking my editor, why are you still making edits on this document? And she said, I haven't touched it in 3 days. It's still catching up. So, like, whoa. I was getting emails from Google saying, hey, your editor made this change, and it was like noon or something like that on a Tuesday, and she said she hadn't touched it since Saturday. So, you know, it did have some problems once it got to a certain length. And there's obviously ways to address that as well. I mean, I could have separated the chapters out into much smaller instead of having just one giant document, and then have each chapter its own individual Google Doc. And that probably would have solved the problem a heck of a lot better than, you know, the way that we were working on it. So I would definitely recommend going, you know, do not throw everything all into a single Google Doc, separate it out into different chapters. That makes it a lot easier to reorder it as well. And then once we got back to a certain point where most of the writing was done, then I handed it over to a layout editor who took everything and pasted it into Microsoft Word and handed us back a Word document. And then once we got it all into a Word document, the editor and I still went back and forth and handed things off to one another. So it was very, very much a handoff process, because obviously with Scrivener, you can't have both people working on the same document at the same time. And that's kind of really what I recognized as a big problem, you know, with the editing process. It's very difficult to write and have an editor do it. The other option would have been for me to just email a copy of the Word document and then get it back and then take a look at the comments and stuff, fix them in my master copy, and then send another copy of it. But obviously that has its own challenges and drawbacks as well.
So did you glean a lot of this stuff from other people that had written books, or did you just sort of charge out on your own and say, Google Docs, Scrivener, Word, yeah, whatever?
The technical side of stuff, I just kind of figured it out on my own because I already had a copy of Scrivener. So I had looked at it before and I'd used it on occasion. So Scrivener, I think, works really well for writing, especially since it's got this built-in ability for you to set goals, which I mentioned before. I used it when I was writing or using Focus Time to help me meet certain milestones, because you can set like a daily goal or a session goal, for example, and you can say, I want to write 5,000 words for example, and you can just use Focus Timer a couple times and try and get as far as you can to that goal. And it slowly shades itself between, you know, red because you're completely not anywhere remotely close to it, to green when you're really, really close. And, you know, obviously if you go past the goal, then, you know, everything's great for the day, but, you know, the goal resets whenever you reset the application. Most of the stuff is just stuff that I figured out kind of on my own, you know, through the course of writing the book and working with the editor and working with somebody who's doing the layout. It just kind of all came together ad hoc.
Yeah, I'll say Scrivener is very powerful. I mean, I've written one book and it is extremely powerful for writing. But like you said, if you want to pass it on to anybody, it gets pretty arcane in the process of sharing. There's no cloud basis for it or anything. It's a desktop application. So I think there's some room for improvement there for sure.
Sure. Yep. And then the other question you'd asked was, what's the final structure of the book, I believe?
How you're planning on selling it and marketing.
Sure. So in terms of the sales, the book itself is going to be $49. And then I'm going to have essentially three different tiers, kind of following the Nathan Berry route, where there's a $49 tier, a $99 tier, and then a $249 tier. And I also have interviews that I've done with a lot of different people If you go out to the singlefounderhandbook.com, it lists and shows you all the different people that I interviewed for it, including Patrick McKenzie, Brennan Dunn. I was lucky enough to get Gabriel Weinberg of DuckDuckGo as well, and then Josh Ledgard from Kickoff Labs, Brian Castle from Restaurant Engine, Heaton Shaw, Sherry Walling, who's Rob's wife. She's a clinical psychologist, so you know I wanted to draw her in to make sure that we hit upon you know many of the mental aspects. And then I also interviewed Justin Jackson and Nathan Berry.
That sounds awesome.
That's quite a round of guests there.
Yep. And those video interviews will be included in the top tier package for the book.
Neat. And the big day is
pending. I'm still trying to get everything nailed down. The part of the issue is that I'm not going the traditional ebook route where it's just going to be a digital distribution. If that were the case, then I'd probably have a date nailed down right this second. It was previously scheduled for later this week, but I had to push off just because of the physical layouts of the book. If I could just needed to go to a PDF, it wouldn't be as big deal, but I'm having it printed. So when you're printing a book, you have to have it printed, and then they send you a copy of it, and then you have to review it, and then you have to tell them yes or no. And if you say no, then they give you back essentially a digital version of it, and you have to sign off on the digital copy before they'll go to print with it. So there's a lot more logistics and time spent waiting for the printer, because they have to print it, mail it to you, then you have to review it, and you know it's a 330-page book. It's not small. So it's just a lot of extra time that I hadn't anticipated.
And, I presume that there will be a link to where you can buy that on Amazon if you wanted to get just the printed version of that book too. Yes.
Yeah. I'm still working that out. I'm not sure how to do that, but that's another one of those things where it's kind of up in the air right now, and I'll figure it out.
Well, cool. I'm looking forward to seeing it physically in print, possibly with an autograph.
Yes. Well, catch me at MicroConf.
We'll definitely have links, and we'll update those when it comes out of where you guys can find it, either on Amazon or on the singlefounderhandbook.com. So that's very exciting. I know it's been a long time coming, so I'm sure you're ready to push it out the door.
Yep, I am. I definitely am. The book itself, like I said, is at singlefounderhandbook.com. So if anyone's interested, right now there's a email list that is out there. So if you sign up for that, you'll get notified when the book comes out. And I assume that I'll probably be doing some sort of a early bird discount for people who purchase the book within a certain time frame or something along those lines, just so that I can kind of gauge what the demand is for it. And hopefully this will get out to as many people as, everyone in your audience, and help as many people as we possibly can. I mean, I know that lots of people don't necessarily want to be tied to their 9-to-5 jobs and, answering to the pointy-haired boss. So hopefully this will help people.
Great. Thanks for coming on, Mike. We really appreciate your time. And again, that's the singlefounderhandbook.com.
Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Mike. All right. Thanks again to Mike Tabor for a wonderful episode today. If y'all enjoyed the episode, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. 5 stars sure would be appreciated. It just takes a minute, but we would love it, absolutely. All the show notes for this episode can be found at roguestartups.com/episode8. We'll see you next week.